I need to warn you before you go any further in listening to this story. This story may be very upsetting or triggering. Some of the language used may be distressing. Some of the personal experiences and descriptions given by people who are part of the story may be traumatic. This episode, while fitting the usual themes here of media history, commentary, and analysis, contains the documentary I produced in 2016. The interviews in it were conducted in 2001, in the months following a racially motivated murder during a public event in Kitchener, Ontario, about an hour west of Toronto. Through the series of audio pieces that will follow this episode, our intent is to honor the memory of Howard Joel Munro and to connect this story with both historic and contemporary experience. This story happened in Canada 20 years ago.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
I never expected this. I never thought that something like this would actually happen in Kitchener.
It was a racial attack.
I don't think it really is there, definitely. And why it is not there is because perhaps he's a person of color.
Are we going to, like, just sit and, like, wait? I don't think so.
They're yelling, "Come here, you effing nigger, we're gonna kill you."
Imagine, it's the Victoria Day holiday weekend. It's Sunday evening, still a full day of the holiday tomorrow. Thousands of people gather at Victoria Park, the one near downtown Kitchener. The annual fireworks display will light up the sky and boom across the city again tonight, to the delight of young and old, families, friends, couples, and a gang of young white men, racists, angry at some young black men because they are dating white women. It has taken me nearly 15 years to tell this story. It's that hard. A racially motivated murder happens in a city close to where I grew up and had chosen again to call home. The shock of the murder is just the first. The next is lack of reaction, of outrage, of compassion, civility, humanity. The killing of 20-year-old Howard Joel Munro in a crowd in a public place just did not seem to resonate across Waterloo Region in the way one might think a racial attack would. The killing itself is clearly an attack on a racialized young man. Is the community response or lack of outcry another case of racism? Is local media less interested, motivated, engaged in exploring the story because of racism? Is the seemingly slow pace of police investigation another indication of racism? Priority for solving the case? This documentary will not be able to answer all of the questions we explore. I hope the ongoing and evolving series of podcasts that will be packaged with this story will give some more insight and understanding. All of the voices you hear in this documentary come from my original audio gathered in the weeks after the murder on May 20th, 2001. A passing story, it seemed. A killing in the park.
I saw it on TV, and when I saw it, I couldn't believe it. You know, I was at work, I saw it on TV, and almost in denial, because I saw them, you know, it's as they were putting him into the ambulance, the blood, you know, them pumping on his chest and, you know, the oxygen bottle in his mouth. And I was saying to one of the nurses, why does that person look my way? You know, but it's in denial. You know, I'm thinking, nah, can't be. I sent my sisters them to the hospital when they came and they told me that they heard he got stabbed, but they're not sure and they don't know which hospital. I says, well, I saw it on TV and it is sure because I saw it, but almost in denial, thinking, well, it can't be because my brother doesn't fight. It can't be him. It was him. And they got to the hospital. Shortly after 12. And they weren't notified until after 2 that my brother's dead. So when they got there, they thought he was still alive, and he was pronounced dead at 10:25. He had all of his ID, you know, so there's no excuse.
Vanessa Simon is Joel Munro's older sister. He was living with her after coming to Canada from Guyana. Simon is a nurse. Not told her brother had been hurt and taken to the hospital, she sees his body hours later.
They really, you know, did a number on my brother. You know, they kicked him. They, you know, his mouth was burst. His face was a mess. His head, his arm, his You know, it was awful. It's between his finger. He probably tried to either block or whatever it is. His arm was cut. It's hard. You know, it's very hard. When I saw him back, you know, when he came back from the autopsy, you know, I can't understand it. Why somebody would do that, and why do they think they have that right to do this?
Monroe's friend Patrick is with him when a gang of young white men converges on them in the park.
It was a racial attack. When a few attacked me, they're yelling, "Come here, you effing nigger, we're gonna kill you." And I barely managed to get away.
Nigel, another friend of Monroe, is not able to get away. He is stabbed by the attackers. The injury and the loss of his close friend Joel change his life, make it seem less.
Well, since I've been encountered with them, my life has turned around. I used to be a member of a track team. I used to do well in it too. You know, I wanted to do it, and now that I can't do it, I can't concentrate back on my sports, and my friend is gone. My life has turned around. It's like I had to start from scratch all over again with a deeper hole. You know, like you're born with a 50-50 chance. Now I'm born with a zero chance. Like I have nothing to do. I can't do anything anymore. I can't concentrate. Nothing. Like every day, I think about the same thing, and every day is just the same day for me, over and over again.
I meet Nigel and Patrick on the day of a memorial service for Joel, August 18th, 2001, in Victoria Park, at the very spot where their friend was brutally murdered, stabbed, kicked, beaten. I relive the experience, see the scene every time I think about it. There's a small circle of people, friends and family, gathering at the spot. It's a hot summer day. It sounds and smells like summer in the park. A parks worker operating a loud machine decides for some reason he has to pass close to the group while the memorial is underway. Some people on bicycles pass on the pathway nearby. One of the people at the service, who's closer to them, asks later whether I heard a racist comment made by one of the cyclists as they passed. I had not. There's no other reporter, investigator here. Oh, wait. There's a crew from the local TV station gathering video for the 6 o'clock news. They're set up how far away? 50 meters? 100? They're a long way off. Later, I try to catch the story on TV. The tape playback fails. And this moment troubles me still. We're at a memorial service for a young man murdered at a public celebration in a city park in the heart of the city, Kitchener. No one from the city is here to attend. No member of city council, no mayor. But the mayor has sent a letter, which will be read by Reverend Winston Thompson. Vanessa Simon attends his church. On behalf of the city of Kitchener, says the letter from the mayor, it is with the deepest sympathy that I send this message today. It concludes with the line that haunts me still.
Please take this opportunity to remember the best of Howard and return him to your hearts, as he is in your memories, and try to make peace within yourselves.
Return him to your hearts? Is the mayor somehow suggesting it is Howard Joel Monroe who has done wrong? Reverend Thompson has been disturbed about the response, investigation, priority given Monroe's murder since the outset. On the day of the funeral back in May, he goes public with his concerns, with a march on City Hall and then on to police headquarters.
At the funeral, I better like alert people to, you know, to not to just sit back and wait, but to go public. And, I mean, like call for answers, for quick action. So I went to the city hall with as many people as I could get that right after the funeral service. And we, of course, the CKCO and the record, they were present. And they did some footage of it. And then from there we went to the police headquarters. And voice complained with about 8 other people, 8 or 12. And I just took it from there.
Time goes on with no arrest. By the time of the memorial service, 3 months after the murder, Patrick finds it strange that no one is charged.
I don't know, because there was witnesses here, a whole, maybe more than 25, 30 witnesses. Me as one, my other friend as another witness. People that know this gang that did it said it was them, recognized a few of them. I don't know why the cops haven't made any arrests yet. I don't know.
It undermines the credibility of the police in the view of Reverend Thompson.
It is that by the black community that is really looking at the police, that if they allow the gang slingers to get by with this, that the reputation of the police amongst blacks or amongst youth, but especially blacks, is going to be like pretty well zero.
By this time, the Monroe case has caught the attention of the Black Action Defense Committee in Toronto. The group has spoken out on issues of justice for black people, often for people harmed at the hands of police. Dudley Laws is a co-founder of the Black Action Defense Committee.
To me, it's really appalling that when somebody is killed in the presence of so many people and so many suspects, that no arrest has been made.
Laws has a lot of questions months after the murder of Joel Monroe. It strikes him that race has something to do with the pace of the investigation.
The questions are being asked, what is the problem? Why wasn't there no reward posted? You know, that people would be encouraged to come forward. Why there no expression of protection being stated by the police? Say, we will protect you if you give information. So we see this as an extension of the kind of racist attitude within the administration of justice. For I can tell you, if it were 50 young black youth who attack a white youth in Kitchener, I think we would find all the black youth in Kitchener would be calling by police and being questioned about the action. This is not the case when it's the other way around.
It's 1 year after the murder when the chief of the Waterloo Regional Police discusses the case with me. I have been pursuing the story independently, but in my day job at the time, I am the producer and co-anchor of the CHUM Radio Network National News out of Toronto. We have a radio station in Kitchener that airs the daily newscast. In that capacity, I've been asking the police for an interview about the Monroe case, leading up to the first anniversary of the killing, still with no arrest taking place. I tell the police I'll produce a story for the Canada-wide audience with or without their input, though I would prefer to have them heard. Larry Greville is police chief at the time, insisting it's still a thorough and significant investigation that is underway 1 year after the murder.
It's a significant commitment of resources. I think in an 800-member organization to have 15 people involved on a single case, and it's a significant one to our service. It's very significant to our community, and we have people that are dedicated to this, have worked very, very hard on this from the outset, and there have been hundreds of tasks and leads that have developed and are being followed through, and this is one that is very perplexing and at the same time very complex.
But could racialization of the dead man possibly be a factor in the slow pace of the investigation? Chief Greville bristles at the question.
I think that's absolutely ludicrous, and there is no one really that has a community member that has really developed that. We've had people outside of our community who have made those ridiculous allegations in the past, but people of all races that we join together with in a community committee absolutely refute that notion, and it's something that is regarded by our service as absolutely nonsensical.
As 15 police officers continue to investigate the murder of Monroe, Vanessa Simon waits, struggling to accept the loss of her younger brother.
But I'm hoping part of me that when all of this is over with, then my brother will come back. And that's the hardest part. Because I know that he would never come back. You know, he's never coming back. My job is part of death and dying, you know. And I understand and I know fully well that when someone dies, they're not coming back, you know. But, you know, there's still a part of me, you know, that wants him back because he was so young, you know, 20 years old.
Monroe's friend Patrick struggles on, also mourning the loss and living in fear of the gang.
After the incident has happened, they send a death threat to me saying they're looking for me, I'm next, no mercy, they're going to kill me. They're driving around with the machetes saying they're gonna kill me, there is no mercy.
It's more than 2 years before anyone is arrested in the gang attack on Joel Monroe. Three young white men are charged with first-degree murder. Each fights that charge, appealing to a higher court, before the appeal is dismissed and they are ordered to stand trial on a charge of first-degree murder. By now, it's November 2004. David Miller pleads guilty to manslaughter, admitting to punching Monroe in the head. After time served since his arrest, he spends one more day in jail. Robert Barges pleads guilty to second-degree murder, admitting to stabbing Joel Monroe. Dirk Young, described as the leader of the gang that attacked Monroe, faces trial and is convicted of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to life, but will have a chance at parole. On a website where prison inmates advertise looking for women to connect with, a man named Dirk Young posts that he is looking for great friendship and someone to have some laughs and fun with, adding, "I'm a lifer, and you can Google my shameful and regrettable crime." Virtually nothing comes up in a web search. The life and death of Howard Joel Monroe and the eventual arrest and trial of his assailants remain largely unreported, unexamined, undocumented, apparently of little interest.
A Killing in the Park, a Paul Cross documentary. Copyright Paul Cross, 2016.
In the coming episodes, my colleague, Dr. Stanley Doyle Wood, and I will discuss our findings from both theoretical and historical perspectives, including those of racialization, marginalization, representation, and news production.